Good evening, everyone. This is Ruthie, and I'm here for the American Music Show. It's John McEwen's stage online. He's recording right now, so he can't entertain us, but we do have three very, very short shows that we did here with him, and they have so much information that I don't want you to miss any of them. The first one he broadcast on February 10th, and it was about the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's trip to Russia. The second was broadcast on February 13th, and that one has a tremendous amount of information about setting up your music properly, having a manager, getting your paperwork in order, and your artwork, doing that first. And the third is more, what I call Music 101, that many people don't have the information. They're not ready to set up a CD. They're not ready to release it because they don't have all the parts and pieces. And he's explained in grand detail how to go about that. And we're also going to listen to quite a few of his numbers. They're quite beautiful. If anyone is looking for romantic music, banjo and guitar and mandolin absolutely serve the purpose. So let's start tonight with the February 10th broadcast. Here's John McEwen.
Hey, Ruthie. How you doing?
Fine, John. And you?
I'm good. And people know who you are, but who am I?
John McEwen. You're one of the founders of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yep, back in 1966, August 12th, around noon. Ah, the good old day. You know something, Ruthie? I'm really glad that you've asked me to be part of syndicatednews.net. It's not just an honor, it's a privilege. And I appreciate the fact that your people out there that are tuning you in might want to hear about American music. So it's really good to be getting to know your people on syndicatednews.net. And I thought maybe they'd like to get to know me. So I put together a little, what would we call this, an internet gift? Let me tell you some of my story, Ruthie. Would you like to hear it?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I put this together at my house just last week. I'll send this out to anyone that's listening. Kind of an old-time radio show. And this is John McEwen. You can find me right here on syndicatednews.net. John McEwen, American Music.
For over 35 years, I've traveled the world, dragging my acoustic instruments with me, my banjo, guitar, fiddle, and mandolin. It's been a great road so far, but it just seems like it's time to tell all of you who are tuning in some of what these instruments have seen and heard. Performing both with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and on my own, these instruments have crossed many strange paths. Played over 6,000 shows, shared a lot of dressing rooms and stages with a lot of wonderful and strange performers, actors, comedians, managers, agents, and roadies. I'll be tracing some of the relationships of all these people, the music behind the scenes and in the studios, and the effects of some of their influences. Let's see, where to start? Now let's start at the beginning. The beginning of my band's career, that'd be good. Around the time of our first performance review in Billboard magazine, when they said, "Doubtful if they'll ever be captured on record." In 1966, we were rehearsing at the famous Ash Grove in Hollywood, California, getting ready for our first week of real work there. We'd only been together a few months, and we'd landed the job opening for the great Merle Travis. We had a whole week that we'd get to play, Tuesday through Sunday. And only two shows a night for $600. Each of us were making $100 a week, and it seemed like a dream come true. Mid-rehearsal in walks a moderately long-haired, inquisitive southern gentleman in a suit and tie with a curious question. "Would ye all like to record for the Liberty Record Company?" He didn't know that earlier that week, we'd signed with Liberty Records to make our first album, but that's just the way it was then. He'd just written a giant hit, one of his early songs for Gary Lewis and the Playboys. Let's just tune in to what some of that time period was like as we get started here. And where radio was at. I mean, you were hearing Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles and the Beach Boys and Joan Baez sometimes. And then this Diamond Ring would come on. What a strange time it was back then. Well, that's 1965 rock and roll. Part of it, anyway. And the young man that wrote this song had come out from Tulsa, Oklahoma in the late 50s. He had a couple of recordings, was kind of unknown, but respected within the industry. He left our session there, our rehearsal, after listening to a few tunes, and pretty soon his solo career was going to take off. It wasn't too many years after running into him here that, well, he hadn't been so many places yet, but he was singing songs for us. And here's one of his early ones, singing this song for you.
My life and time, I've sung a lot of songs I've made from bad rhymes. I've acted out my love in stages with 10,000 people watching, but we're alone now and I'm singing this song to you.
Oh yeah, that's Leon Russell.
I know your image of me is what I hope to be. Treat you unkindly, but darling, can't you see?
I don't think he ever treated anyone unkindly. We were all looking for the same thing, trying to make what would be called old records. And the Dirt Band, in those formative years, we'd also play a place called the Troubadour, which was kind of like the Greenwich Village of the West Coast. And we saw a guy there, Michael Nesmith. Everybody knows the answer to what did Michael Nesmith's mother invent? Well, Michael himself came up with some really good songs. I played my banjo on this one. From 1970.
Tell me just one more time the reason why you must leave. Tell me once more why you're sure you don't need me. Tell me again, but don't think you'll convince me.
We put this song on our fifth album, called Uncle Charlie and His Dog Teddy. Jerry Jeff Walker had a song that we learned just in time to put on that album. We thought it was going to be an album cut. Didn't think it would have any success as a radio record other than maybe FM airplay. We were wrong. Maybe you remember this one.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you in worn out shoes. Her hair in ragged shirt and baggy pants, the old soft shoes. He jumped so high, he jumped so high, and then he lightly touched down.
We recorded this in 1969.
I met him in a cell in New Orleans. I was as the smoke ran out,
everybody sing along. Thanks to a lot of people requesting this song, it got played to death on the radio and put us on the road. It was from our fifth album. And we became America's first group, the first American band to go to Russia in 1977. Let's get back to my earlier path that led me to, well, where I am today. Hey, the Dirt Band's been on the road for 40 years, and so have I. Maybe a little banjo story would be a good start. One time I was out on the road with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, hanging out at some hotel in the Midwest. We're just waiting for a show at a county fair somewhere in the middle of the boondocks. And just hanging out on a nice summer day. And the phone rings. And it was Leon on the phone. And I don't know how he found us, but it was a different time back then. Harder to find people. And he was asking me if I'd ever heard of somebody, and I couldn't place the guy. And since the whole band was in the room, I turned and said, Hey, Jeff, you know who Bill Wyman is? And Jeff said, why, he's a bass player with the Stones. Why? I said, well, I just wondered. I went back to the phone and said, sure, Leon, put Bill on. I talked to him for 5 minutes or so, and I ended up a couple days later in L.A. to record on Bill Wyman's solo album, Monkey Grip. The weirdest thing about it, I mean, here, you know, I'm a banjo player, you know. And this is a Rolling Stone. I mean, what am I doing here? But Leon, when I arrived, he said, John, I'm glad you're here. I'm not used to hanging out with a bunch of stars. I'm just here to play my three licks and move on. That made me feel better. But then he said, get your banjo out. And he made me go into the control room and play a tune for Bill Wyman. I don't think it was an audition. He just wanted to hear. Here's the way I recorded it on the Uncle Charlie and His Dog Teddy album with the Dirt Band. This is Opus 36. I think it might have gotten me a job with the Rolling Stone. Well, that went well, and I played dobro and mandolin and banjo and on Wyman's album. That was a lot of fun. And the cool thing about it was Leon was in kind of a hurry to get out of there. Let's play one of the cuts from Monkey Grip. Let's play White Lightning from the Monkey Grip album by Bill Wyman.
Can't you feel it hit ya? Feel it get ya? Just the jerk, can't you feel it? Oh, white lightning sure tastes good. Knew a man lived on a hill, had a whiskey still. People. miles around. Drink his whiskey down. Can't you feel it, hit ya? Feel it, hit ya? It's a jerk, can't you feel it, hit ya? Oh, white lightning sure tastes good. Knew a man had a mule. What a stubborn fool. Put some liquor in his feet. Fastest thing I see. Can't you feel it, hitcher? Feel it, hitcher. Just a jerk, can't you feel it, hitcher? Oh, white lightning sure tastes good.
After the sessions, Leon, well, I figured a limo was going to pick him up or something, but he turned to me and said, hey, John, you heading into town? And I don't know if you know L.A. or not, but that's a pretty big question. I was heading over to Burbank where Arlo was recording, and I said, Leon, do you have a limo? He goes, no, I figured I'd get a ride with you. And that kind of cracked me up. And he wanted to go along to see Arlo Guthrie recording, and I wanted to see what happened when those guys got in the same room together. Arlo was complaining about how John Denver had changed the words to Steve Goodman's City of New Orleans. It seems like Mr. Denver had to change old black men to old gray men to make it radio friendly. And we'd all be proud later to be able to call John Denver a friend. And, well, Arlo had a hit with his version. And, see what happens if we mix them up a little bit.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central Monday morning rail. There's 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors and 25 sacks of mail. They're out on a southbound Odyssey, and the train pulls out of Kankakee, rolling past the houses, farms, and fields. Passing towns that have no names, the freight yards full of old gray men, the graveyards of rusted automobiles.
Passing trains that have no names, the freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobiles. Good morning, America, how are you?
That was written by Steve Goodman. Stevie was one of the best solo acts on the road, besides being a great writer. I believe he's the only person that opened for Steve Martin that would get encores, and he did that a lot. In fact, he did over 250 shows with Steve Martin when he was out on the road. I saw him do it several times. He just got them right in the palm of his hand like he always did. And if he broke a string, it was even better, because he could do 5 minutes while he was replacing the string. He kept right on singing. Boy, he was tough to follow. He opened for the Dirt Band once in Reno, and, well, it was his songs and his attitude. Like this song that, what is that song? If Your Life Was on Videotape, you could play all... Let's hear Stevie Goodman do If Your Life Was on Videotape.
If your life was on videotape, wouldn't everything be all right? When your head hurts the morning after, and you could roll it back to late last night. You could replay all the good parts and cut out what you don't like. Oh, wouldn't you be in good shape? If your life was on videotape.
Steve Goodman was the kind of man that, well, anybody that met him felt like you could call him a friend.
Everybody had.
He's just Mr. Nice Guy. And he wrote some of the coolest songs, and the Dirt Band ended up cutting some of them. One of my favorite songs that we did of his is Face on the Cutting Room Floor. This is from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. A Steve Goodman song goes like this.
No one gives her a
idea in that late 60s Southern California music scene that someday we'd be recording this kind of music in the year 2002. We didn't have any idea that we were going to do anything, actually, other than we were trying to just keep from working. Maybe stay out of the draft a little bit. Pretty drafty back then. It was a different time. You didn't get together as a group and say, okay, let's make a video and get a manager and an attorney and an accountant and a record company and an agent. You just kind of tried to do it. And some of those people would come to you, like at the Troubadour. They'd show up, the Troubadour, the Ash Grove, the Ice House in Pasadena, the Golden Bear out in Huntington Beach. Boy, that was a hot time. We did a concert on a football field at a high school that had, the Jefferson Airplane, the Doors, the Byrds, the Buffalo Springfield, a group called Merry-Go-Round, and the Dirt Band. And it cost, $5 or $6 to get in. Birmingham High School. Rock out. I remember that night I was most excited about getting the show over with so I could go see Bill Monroe at the Ash Grove. But as the band moved along, some people started coming to us with songs. And one of the young men that showed up at about 17 years old, he'd been living in his Jeep out in the desert, and, hey, would you guys want to do some of my songs? I had him come up to my house. I was living in Laurel Canyon. Now, Laurel Canyon, it was just like some of the songs. Down the street was Jimmy Messina. He was not even in Poco yet. Across the street, Scott McKenzie, Flowers in Your Hair. Next door was Ian Whitcomb. Down the street a little further on the right was the Mamas and Papas. Steve Martin lived up at the top of the street. But this young kid came over to my house, and he'd just written a bunch of songs, and I had a stereo tape recorder. Now, you're going to have to bear with me on this, because I didn't know much about recording then, and sometimes he pops the microphone a little bit. But this is like, I'd like to call this the audio lithograph portion of the show. I'll be introducing some pieces of music that nobody's ever heard before. In the way that I recorded them from my own little private collection to try and capture those days as they were going by. But coming into the studio, into my living room in my little one-bedroom place, to lay down some songs so we could record them maybe on the next album, this young man came in, and this is the way he played it at 17 years old. I think the song was about a month old.
Okay. Good. Dash A. Oh, take four. Okay. Now it's
have a face, a girl, let's change my name. And I'm through with the game. Spoiled never be the same. Even though we ain't got money, I'm so in love with the honey, and everything will bring a chain of love. In the morning when I rise, you bring a tear of joy to my eyes and tell me everything's gonna be alright.
Yeah, that's a teenage Kenny Loggins of 1968. This is before he'd had any songs recorded by anybody. We learned four songs off that living room tape I made up in Laurel Canyon of Kenny, and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band put those songs on an album called Uncle Charlie and His Dog Teddy. Thanks, Kenny, for helping us out there. You know, it was a great time back then, as it is now, and just different. And sometimes it was hard to find a way to get away. With the Vietnam War heating up like it was a tough time to be draft age. Well, there was a need to get away, and I found it at a place called the Hawk Shop on Sunset Boulevard. And the guy that ran the place was Spencer Quinn.
What?
That's him.
Okay.
I recorded this at the Hawk Shop in 1968. And Spencer was quite a guy. He used to be in the Our Gang comedies. Yeah, that was a strange claim to fame. And he drew in an even stranger group of people. Looking for a place to go. Not very many of them. But one of them was Paul Williams, a great songwriter. And his brother, Minter Williams. Minter is, I guess he's about 10 years away from writing that Give Me the Beat That Thrills My Soul, I Want to Get Lost in Your Rock and Roll. And at this time, we were just hanging around trying to find respite from the Sunset Strip madness. Ah, yes, the Whiskey a Go-Go
with Three Dog Night.
Imagine, within just a couple miles range, you can see the Byrds or Three Dog Night or Mance Lipscomb or Lightning Hopkins or Bill Monroe or the Doors might have played a high school that afternoon. We all played high school. And the Association, the Canned Heat. What a mess. Paul Williams was still, about a year away from writing We've Only Just Begun, and that started out as a bank commercial. He drove into town in a stolen car and pulled up to A&M Records lot, which had been the Charlie Chaplin lot. A&M had bought it with their Tijuana brass money, and Paul went in and sold his first song, paid for the car, and started writing more songs. It was at the Hawk Shop that I heard an old song that Spencer did, and it describes what we were all after, what we were trying to be, what it was all about. We just wanted to be old records, I think. And I thought it was ironic how this old song kind of told what everybody in Hollywood was after, at least the people I was running across, the music people, what everybody was trying to get done. It just kind of came down to one thing. We're all trying to make old records.
Get out those old records, those old phonograph records, the ones we used to play so long ago. What if they sound scratchy? Those tunes really were catchy, especially those that say, I love you so.
I recorded this in 1968 on Sunset Boulevard at this old Hawk Shop, he called it. We hadn't figured things out yet. We were just trying to make some old records. The next night, I went up to a guy's house that I'd been hanging out with. Well, he lived with us for about 4 months. His band had just broken up, and most of them headed back to Florida. And he was working on a new song.
Keep going, just keep it rolling.
Now we can hear him doing it right now. Now this is live from the living room. This is the day he finished writing this song. I'm not going to tell you who it is yet, but you'll know this guy's voice. And please forgive the funky recording quality, but it was the best I could do in this guy's apartment back then.
testifies about our bad, bad misfortune. And I ain't here to wonder why, but I live on.
Well, in case you haven't guessed, this is Greg Allman at 19 years old.
I wrote you a letter.
It was a short while after this recording that Greg decided to leave town. He left Hollywood and he went to Jacksonville, Florida, about 2 weeks later for that first night of the Allman Brothers. And that was the first recording of that song before they even started. That's some of my own music in the background right now. That's called Miner's Night Out. I remember going down I-70 heading to Colorado somewhere in the 80s. I tuned my banjo to that low B note the diesel was putting out. And made up a tune that I thought maybe the miners would have played in the 1800s. Well, I'll be playing in your town pretty darn soon. Bringing my banjo, guitar, mandolin, and fiddle, and music from the Circle B Unbroken albums, and my favorite dirt band songs. Check me out, johnmcewen.com, M-C-E-U-E-N. And thanks for tuning in.
Thank everybody for joining us here at the John McEwen American Music Show. He is recording, so he can't join us right now. He's busy making more beautiful music. In any case, I want to salute Derek from Providence, Utah, our silent co-host. He's in Providence, Utah. We don't know much else about him, but we know that he visits our show quite regularly, and we appreciate him. In any case, we're going to go on to play some more of John McEwen's music and his other shows because they have so much rich information. It sounded like a historical as he was going through all those musicians that have now become part of American music history. We're going to also share with you the February 20th program. And remember, John McEwen is here.
Right here on syndicatednews.net. John McEwen, American Music.
That's correct. Sunday nights at 11, John McEwen. And here's his February 13th program. We enjoyed this one again because of all of the very, very important information he shared with us. So we're back here at Syndicated News again, and today we're interviewing John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
That's me.
Welcome back. So nice to have you here with us.
Like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.
So let's get right to it.
What's on your mind?
Well, what if people said is the most important aspect of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's trip to Russia?
Well, one thing that a lot of people don't remember that the Dirt Band was the first American group to go there in 1977. But the ones that do ask, what happened? What was it like? It was like going, well, it's like a whole other country over there, Ruth. And we saw a picture of America that gave us more appreciation for the word freedom than I'd imagined. I mean, I grew up in Orange County, California, home of the John Birch Society. So you always heard that kind of viewpoint, which was fine with me. I like it here. But over there, when you were in a country where people couldn't tell a joke about their leader because it would be treason and they go to jail, I'd say it would be indicated by the first night we were in the Hotel Lucia, something like 5,000 rooms. I'm not sure because they weren't sure. I asked, how many rooms do you have here? I said, oh, we don't know exactly how many rooms we have here.
How interesting.
Well, why is that? Well, sometimes it's a fire in one room, and sometimes one room doesn't work, so we don't know how many rooms we have, but there's somewhere around 5,000. Biggest hotel in the world. There was a band playing in the lounge, and we listened, and they knew we were the American group that had come over. There was lots of publicity about it, and not because the Dirt Band had ever been on the radio or anything. Our publicity and the fact that we sold out our 28 shows, an average of 2,000 to 4,000 seat rooms, was because we were an American group, a group that was making its musical decisions in either an anarchic or democratic way. A band, you know, not one lead guy. Well, this group invited us to come up and play on their equipment, which was really the worst. It was a Czechoslovakian copy of a Japanese copy of a Fender guitar, things like that. Strings on the guitars were tied down at the end because they'd been broken. The cymbals were taped up where they were cracked. They weren't replaced. We did about a half hour set. About 5 hours later, me and one of my buddies that was taken, I brought over to shoot pictures, we were walking back to the hotel after being around Red Square at midnight, and we could hear this music. And this band was back in their dressing room, which was basically a broom closet with more broom room than band room. And they'd recorded our show on a little Wallensack tape recorder. And they were playing back and forth. They'd play 30 seconds and they'd stop and start talking to each other, all excited. Then they'd run it back and they'd play it again. And then they'd move on and keep playing. And they were chattering all the time. And I kind of opened the door and they were so excited to see us. And I asked, why do you keep running the tape back? Because I didn't think we played that well. And they all said, we can hear freedom in your music. What we're doing, will the circle be unbroken? We can hear the freedom of your country. You are doing the solo that this man played. He was playing from his heart. He wasn't playing what he was told. The songs you played, they were so free and open and reckless abandon, I guess would be what was exhibited in that recording.
That would put a lump in your throat.
Oh, it was killer. It does right now, to this day. And we were told, after this tour, that this might help open the door to American music coming into Russia. Well, I was asked to come to a meeting in San Francisco at Bill Graham's office because he had...
Mention who Bill Graham is.
At the request of Bill Graham in San Francisco, the number one promoter in the country that started Winterland and, you know, Fillmore and gave the Grateful Dead a place to play, promoted them. He was the number one promoter in the country. He had put together a tour with Chicago and a bunch of bands going to Russia. And he wanted to hear what my impression was in this meeting, which I kind of started as, well, I'm the banjo player in the Dirt Band, and I'm glad to talk to you about our trip. We played 28 shows, and never once in any city did we have over 100 volts of power, and it wasn't clean power. So make sure you take line transformers and voltage, what is it?
Converters?
No, not just converters. A thing that cleans up the ground on the voltage.
Mm-hmm.
So otherwise, you would have enormous buzzing in the whole system. And be prepared to run your shows on 95 volts. Sometimes we were down as low as 88 volts. And this is in Moscow, Leningrad, Georgia. One time we got up to about 102, and that makes the equipment louder and more efficient. There was one show we were doing, the sound mixer, and I'm telling him this. He just had everything on the mixing board turned up to 10, and that was all he could do. And the equipment was getting hotter and hotter because the lower the voltage, the more inefficient it runs. And be prepared, I told him about what I learned the first night. I asked the people, no, I don't want to go back to the hotel for dinner. Just bring me something. I was surprised that they had a shocked face. I said, well, just bring me whatever you're having. And when they brought the food back, it was wrapped in newspaper. Because they don't have takeout food. They didn't know takeout food. They didn't have a paper plate. They couldn't bring the plate from the restaurant. I had a fish in the newspaper that was cooked. And be prepared to not have dressing rooms that are like you might be accustomed to here. And be prepared that your stage crew will be the Red Army. And maybe they've never moved a piano, but that's who's going to have to move it. And be prepared for the fact that it's illegal to stand up in a Soviet concert. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, when we were playing the bike track to 4,500 people for 5 days, every day it was, the audience would have all their heads turned to the left. Imagine a real slow tennis match. And then a few minutes later, they'd all turn to the right. And we couldn't figure out what was going on. They're not looking at the stage. They were looking at people in various parts of the grandstands that were standing up dancing until the security came up and either took them out or made them sit down. And I went on through a list of things like that about transportation and the difficulty of moving simple things and the fact that the hotels were not going to be accessed by any non-foreigners because the hotels were only for the foreigners. Don't expect to bring any Soviet friends into the hotel that you might make because it's illegal and it's not advertised that way. And be prepared to be watched by the KGB every day. Be prepared to have hookers come up to the band to try and engage them, because we did, but they were KGB hookers. Just the long list of things. And also, Mr. Graham, I think you should be prepared for this tour not happening. Oh, we've got contracts. I've got trucks in Europe. I have one band's in London on the way, blah, blah, blah. It's about a week from now. I says, well, this is just this banjo player's opinion, but you have contracts with the Soviet Union, and they don't care. Anyway, 4 days later, his whole tour was canceled. There's no way they're going to allow 100,000 people in Red Square when they've seen what happened to us with 2,000 people in a room or 4,000 people in a bike track. These people were free for an hour and a half, and I don't think that's going to be possible. They were planning a big concert in Red Square. They won't want to handle it. And sure enough, for the next 3.5 years, no American music got in there.
I worked in St. Petersburg. I worked on cruise ships teaching software applications, and we would We would stop in St. Petersburg, and then I'd get on a plane and fly them to Moscow for 2 or 3 days, and we'd fly back. But most importantly, what I remember most was that every crew member and every passenger had to get off one at a time. And when you walked down the gangway, the foot of the gangway were young boys, I would say 16 and 17, wearing the KGB uniform and carrying a huge automatic rifle of sorts. Mm-hmm. But because of the cold and because of their nervousness, they were physically trembling. And they had their finger on the trigger, and what terrified me, and I kept begging my liaison at St. Petersburg, please have them put the barrels down, because if they trip or get pushed or are nervous, they're going to shoot the passengers. And they refused. And every single passenger had to come off that gangway facing a young boy.
A fire squad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they were holding their guns up, and we were terrified that by mistake they would shoot one of us.
Mm-hmm.
When it was my turn, I begged them, please put the guns down, please. I'm terrified. And I can say, someone translate that I'm terrified. Could they please point the weapons elsewhere? I was actually shaking, but so were they.
Mm-hmm.
It was cold, and they were shaking, and they were freezing, and their hands were raw and red. And these were young boys, 16, 17. They could not be older than 17. They were young boys.
What year was that? 98, 2000?
Earlier.
Did the airline still fly on Moscow time only?
Moscow time only. We took a small plane from St. Petersburg to Moscow. We were there for 2 or 3 days, and then we would fly back. And I was the chaperoness.
When we were there, all plane flight times were on Moscow time, even if you were three time zones away.
Yes.
What time is the flight? 7 o'clock. But we're in Georgia, and so it's actually 9 o'clock for us. It would always just post Moscow time.
That's right. And I remember we went to the finest hotel, and we brought thousands of people in the finest hotels in the restaurant on the first floor. Of course, they had the wonderful dish of borscht, which I just couldn't get anymore. And that was in their fine restaurant. And
right.
It was the nicest thing they had. You can't say anything because these people are going all out to bend over backwards.
Oh, yeah. So a toilet. You don't have to bother with that flushing thing like the Americans have.
I know. But that was the circumstance, so we had to be polite. I've been to Russia. I understand what you're saying. Absolutely. And that was the show that we enjoyed on February 13th, and we played it again on Valentine's Day. So now let's go towards that beautiful music that we haven't heard for a while. Let's talk about John McEwen Fishers. Does anybody know that song? John McEwen's Fishers? Well, let's try it. This is a song that I haven't played often, and here we go. John gave a really, I call it Music 101. He gave a really good and detailed explanation about how one should begin to set up the business portion of releasing an MP3, a CD, music in general. This is invaluable information, and here we go.
So we're back here at Syndicated News again, and today we're interviewing John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
That's me.
Welcome back. So nice to have you here with us.
Like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.
So let's get right to it.
What's on your mind?
Now, John, it's been said, and by too few, that the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was an equal contributor to the mystic country rock scene of the late 60s and early 70s. What do you think about that?
Well, are you familiar with Burrito Brothers and people like that?
Mm-hmm.
And the Sweetheart of the Rodeo album?
Yes.
Those are great records.
Go on.
If they really believed that country music was viable, because they quit. They did it for a few years and walked away.
Why?
Now, I don't know why. I never listened to their music. We had our own influences. We were recording. I'm very proud of the fact that the Eagles said in a couple of early interviews that, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was a big influence on us. And I don't know exactly how, but I'm not glad they said it. But the Dirt Band continued to the point where we risked our entire career making Will the Circle Be Unbroken, an acoustic traditional country album that right after we had two pop hits, American Dream in 79 and Make a Little Magic, that are considered classic rock, we went quote unquote country. And our first number one record was around 1982 with Long Hard Road, a Rodney Crowell song. And for the next 6-7 years, we had 17 country radio hits. We were on the Grand Ole Opry. We were on the country tour in Europe with Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard and people like that. We were a bunch of hippies using banjo, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, harmonica. And I just think the Dirt Band deserves more credit for that. And I think part of the problem is the name, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Sounds kind of like 1910 Fruit Gum Company or something. But I'm proud of our accomplishments. I'm not whining about that. I'm just saying that we have a star on the walk in Nashville, and they chose to put it next to Hank Williams Sr. My God, the country industry and the people that vote for that kind of thing saw something, but not very many of the Rolling Stone type of people. Although Rolling Stone did say about the Circle Be Unbroken album, one of the most important records to come out of Nashville.
And John, of the many times you thought you were recording a hit, how many times were you right?
Well, that's a weird thing, Ruth, because people always like to think they're recording hits. bands don't make hit records. They record songs and the audience makes them hits. Somehow the magic combination of stuff happens. They call in, they tell their friends about something they heard, a writer loves it right at the right time when somebody might play it. But there are times, like when we were the group that played the music for my friend Steve Martin, who my brother was managing for King Tut, we knew King Tut was going to be a smash. When we recorded Bojangles, we really felt like we knew a lot of people are going to like this song. The minute I started hearing playing my guitar and detuning and we're in the studio and he was doing a live vocal, I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I'm listening to the radio right now. There's been about 5 or 6 times that that's happened. And there's been a couple other times when I thought it could be a hit or this should be, but nothing. Didn't go anywhere for whatever reasons, just didn't go anywhere.
Do you think it's harder or easier to get new music out nowadays, or is it possibly easier because of the technology?
It's easier to get it out. It's harder to get attention. In the days of L.A. and the music scene I grew up in, KHJ, Channel 90, whatever, we just heard Aretha Franklin coming up as Counting Flowers on the Wall, and pretty soon we got a new Beatles cut. But first, here's Joan Baez, and this was pop radio, the number one station.
Yes.
Okay, it was harder to get through the filter that puts you in that, but you sure covered a lot more people and you got them all at once. And now there's 1,100 stations saying, well, here's the pre-1950 bluegrass traditional station. Or you're listening to the Jewish Vietnamese hour. I mean, it's just so hard. It's harder to get the attention of an audience because there's thousands of billboards on the freeway.
Now, with recordings being made and replicated and reproduced digitally, what do you think the younger generation might be missing because of it?
They're missing a broader spectrum of sound. It's like they're looking at the Mona Lisa through a pair of sunglasses and go like, wow, what colors? It's like you go to see The Last Supper, but you've got glasses on that only show you 9 people at the table. Still a great painting. Hey.
I love your analogies.
Thank you. I appreciate that. They just popped up. It's a strange thing because analog really does sound wonderful. Digital, you give up a lot of sound. But with the older audience, over 45, you've lost 10% of your hearing anyway. And it's so much easier to move an MP3 around. But MP3 sounds worse than CD. But the machines that you use to reproduce them, I'll just pop my iPhone into my little automatic holder that has a 4-inch speaker next to it and one across the room somewhere, and you hear it, but you're not hearing all of it. So a combination. Digital helps get the information out there and maneuver it and manipulate it, but it also has opened up the playing field to where it's just massive. It's like having 100 quarterbacks on the football field, and they're all good, maybe, but which one do you hike to?
I enjoy it when I'm talking to someone about one topic or another and they use football references. I'm from Manhattan. I know nothing about football. Nothing. Nothing.
Well, they get 2 points every time you get the basket at the end of the field, right?
Basket. I thought it was basketball. But in any case, I digress. Of the few proudest moments, however many they were, as far as a time when you knew it would be tough and the band pulled through and you came out on top. Give me some examples.
Got time for 2?
Okay.
Do you?
Yeah.
I'll go to 1.
Yeah, yeah.
We did 12 shows with Bobby Sherman. Julie, 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 do you love me? The first 2 shows, the Teeny Boppers hated us. we had to figure out how to get to this audience because you don't want to do the other 10 shows sucking, right?
Mm-hmm.
We figured it out. By the first song, how many are here to see Bobby Sherman? Scream, scream, scream. Come on, you got to scream louder than that if you want him to hear you. Scream, scream, scream. You got your flashbulbs ready? Yes. Okay, here's another song. The next song. Okay, we got to make sure those flashbulbs are working. On the count of three, get ready. We're going to test them. One.
Is that right?
Two, three. You know what 4,000 flashbulbs going off at once looks like? And it was, everybody would scream because it was so much fun. And here's another song. Oh, and the next song would be like, Bobby told us that we should play this next song for you because he thinks you'll like it. Anything we could think of. We ended up getting encores, and then we worried, oh, my God, the Bobby Sherman audience likes us. But we were glad, huh?
I thought that's what you wanted.
Well, we did, but then we couldn't go home telling people, how was the Bobby Sherman tour? Oh, they loved us, those 14-year-olds. It was a different time. We were hip. But Bobby was really cool. Bobby, does it bother you? The girls scream all the way through your set. Ah! And then he'd start a song, Julie, Julie. Ah! It would get down to a certain level. And he told me in Hartford, Connecticut, it doesn't bother me because I know something they don't. And I said, what's that? He said, I can't sing. And when they stop screaming, they'll find out. I figure I've got about a year and a half.
Is that right?
Yeah, now he's an EMT in L.A.
Are you serious?
Yeah, 5 years ago he was. But
wow.
Version into situation two?
Yes, please.
That was a Bobby Sherman incident. And then let's go ahead about 25 years, because this band's been together more than any four bands you can add up, usually.
Mm-hmm.
45th year of Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And we're in the 90s. We're on a 12-act tour in Europe. It's like 10 cities, Frankfurt, you know, Wembley Arena, stuff like that. Well, the last date was Switzerland, Geneva, big 12,000-seat auditorium. Our turn, which we were going on just before Johnny Cash, was coming up, and we're heading to the stage, and I noticed the entire cast, from Bill Monroe to Johnny Russell to, I think, Crystal Gayle was on that show, and her band, everybody's walking out to the stage. And I say to Johnny Russell, who wrote I Got a Tiger by the Tail and all kinds of great songs, Johnny, what's going on? Why is everybody, well, John, none of us have gotten to these people today, and we figure if you guys don't, it wasn't our fault. And these people were going out to watch us crucify ourselves. They felt like everybody was waiting for Johnny Cash. Well, the first three or four songs were a little bit quiet in response. But the next song, when I said, I grew up in Orange County and I wasn't weird playing the banjo. I had an East German shepherd. Well, the audience in Switzerland speaks English. I had an East German shepherd. It kept people in my yard. And the people just cracked up. And this song is one of our biggest hits, Bojangles. The next song, we got into the Cajun music. Jimmy started chasing me around, and I chased him around on stage. I'm up on a speaker cabinet. The next song was Battle of New Orleans. This is when the British tried to kick American ass, you know. And in my first fiddle solo, I come running out from behind the drum riser with a British flag on. And then the second solo, I'd ripped off the British flag shirt and the American flag. And people were cheering every time something like that. With a third solo, I come out, and I've got the Swiss flag on.
Oh.
And the people went nuts. So then I jumped out in the audience, took my shoes off, and threw them over the heads. And he started Diggy Diggy Low, and people were on their feet. And when that, I almost want to cry over this. When those people from the Grand Ole Opry world said to us, you boys did it tonight. Good job. It was really fun. I mean, We just wanted to make it work. I mean, we just wanted to make it work.
What memories.
Yeah. So it was really fun. Then Bill Monroe came to the club that night. I invited him to sit in. That was really fun. I'd put together a jam session at a Geneva club about 12:30 in the night. I see that white hat coming in with a really beautiful Switzerland girl on each arm. The two of them added together. If you added their ages together, it wouldn't have been as much as he was old.
So tell me two things, something you like and something you don't about touring. Tell me.
I like almost any situation where you can go on in front of people and feel like you made them forget where they were for a while because they liked being where you were taking them. And at the same time, they're taking me somewhere. So when I play solo, I don't do the same thing twice. I have certain songs that the order changes, but I always try to play at least one song in a set that I haven't played before in front of people or something different. And when I can get into that space, it's really fun. It's more fun than sitting at home. I don't sit at home and play the songs and go, okay, here's one. You're probably going to take, oh, there's nobody here. Sit in front of a mirror and say, this will take me back. I do this for the audience. I work for them because I don't have a job. I mean, I wake up in the morning and I don't have to go to work. And when the concerts show up, I call it playing. So that's one thing I really like. As far as don't like, usually the only things I don't like are when there's something weird that impinges upon somebody being in that audience, not having good sound or good lights, or the bathrooms are wrong, or the poor promotion or something like that. And the other thing is the crying babies on an airplane. I've raised 6 kids. They didn't make noise in public. If they did, I took them home. We left 2 restaurants and it only took 2. So
you're very considerate.
Well, I don't like screaming kids in a restaurant or even whining ones. I don't like to hear, mommy, 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 he's touching me at all.
And that's quite common. I took a Virgin Air flight from New York City to London, and I didn't know that there were only several places where you could place a child in a bassinet. And they were in the seats that we had chosen. So we wound up having to fly from New York to London with someone else's child in basically our lap because they pull it down. And I was just so surprised and so disappointed.
The other stuff about, you know, people say, oh, it's really tough to travel. Or I do believe the journey is a major part of the destination overall. I like getting there. I never missed a job, over 8,000 shows, I think, at least.
45 years and 8,000 shows, and you've never missed a job?
Well, there have been some shows that were canceled, but that was because
that's beyond your control. That's not
4 feet of snow had dumped on the town, and there was no power.
Yeah.
But I was there. I was there. I was there.
So why are you doing this?
It's something that I know how to do, and I have people tell me, it was sure good that you came here, because when my brother died, that record you made was played at his funeral.
Oh,
or it was sure good you came here because we got married to that song. Or it's sure good that you came here because my dad hasn't laughed that hard in 2 years.
Oh, my gosh.
It's like a responsibility. If I can do this, then I should as much as possible.
What advice would you give to newcomers, new musicians that have never done business before, that are coming into the industry? What advice would you give them?
Get out now.
No, come on.
I would say, read Hunter Thompson's quote about the music business. A long and narrow plastic hallway full of pimps and thieves where good men die like dogs. There's also a negative side.
That was the positive?
And then I would say, keep in mind that if you're going to make a deal with any company, that they have lawyers to keep as much money as possible for them, not you. Keep in mind that you have to be as smart as a farmer who knows what crop to plant, where to plant, when to plant, and when he harvests it, he knows what his market is. I know so many bands that go, okay, man, we've been together 4 years, and we just finished an album, and hello, we just finished an album. Is anybody listening? No, we better take this somewhere. If you're not ready for that, by the time you get that album placed, it will already be a year and a half old.
Oh, my. So there's a lot of work to be done.
The first thing I say, oh, you got a band and you're going to make a recording? Start the artwork. Well, we got to do the music. No, start the art. You wanted advice. Start the artwork. Well, why is that, man? Because 99% of the time, what will slow down a release is the artwork not being ready. We got the album finished. We're going to put it out first week of August, because if we try to put it out in September, we won't have a chance. That's when all the old guns fire and all the special packages start getting shipped for Christmas. So we got to get it out in August. What? The cover's not done? Oh, you don't have all the copy for the song rights? Oh, we don't have a barcode? We can't put it out till the end of September and nobody's going to want it because they don't want to compete with the whole Christmas season. When do we put it out? January? No, because that's too soon. February? Okay. You're already a half a year behind because you didn't start the artwork.
That's amazing. That's great advice.
Thank you.
I had no idea. The artwork.
The final piece of advice is buy the book Songwriter's Guide to Music Publishing. Songwriter's Guide to Music Publishing by Randy Poe, P-O-E. It is the best definitive guide to where the income stream comes for music that has been freshly, newly created, original music. If you don't have that, then you're just kidding yourself. Oh, I don't need that. I can just write the song. Oh, yeah. Well, somebody else will get the money.
Well, about the artwork, I can't tell you how many times I've spoken to a musician or a publicist that can't interview because they can't come to me with something as silly. And I didn't give it much importance until I just heard you say it. It's almost always their art isn't ready.
Right.
I've heard it so many times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great advice.
And if you don't get the right release window, you'll kill your album. You don't put out an album October 30th. Or unless it's a Halloween hit or something and you can smother the country all at once. You don't put it out in certain months at certain times. And so there's 4 months that are viable for a new release.
What are those 4 months?
That's an opinion of different people. I would say the third week of January through the end of February, possibly the end of April through May so you can get the summer rush. And then not July, because everybody that's done this April-May release is all going to be on top of you, taking up the limited amount of space there is to talk about things. And then maybe early August, just before the rush of mid-September, that's getting the Christmas stuff out there. And then one of the other ones is September 15 to October 15 for the Christmas-oriented product. And if you don't have a repackage of your greatest hits and a special blah, blah, blah that's going to be offered in that regard, you're going to be going up against the box set of Fleetwood Mac and all that other stuff, and Jewel decides to go orchestral, or, you know, everything. It's the Christmas packages. So that's, in my opinion, that's about it.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share all that with us. I'm sure new musicians are going to get a new earful from you, because it's absolutely right about the artwork. I've heard that 1,000 times, and I didn't know about the windows, and that's very important.
You ought to read my book. It's the best one on publishing. And he was right. Okay.
Anything else you want us to play?
Acoustic Traveler is a good example of, I need one more song. Oh, well, I'm not going to go to sleep till I finish this song, this instrumental. So finally at 1 in the morning, I finish. I take it in the studio the next day. I says, oh, and let's throw this in there. I don't know if it's any good or not. And it comes out being a lot of people's favorite thing. That Acoustic Traveler is a favorite thing I've ever heard you do. My favorite thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't judge your own material is the comment I make there.
Excellent.
It's, so many songwriters go, oh, this, I'm just going to stick it on the album, and it's the acoustic hit that gives the group a career, or it's the one that turns into something that they didn't expect.
This is just marvelous. I can't thank you enough for the time. This has been John McEwen here at syndicatednews.net, and we're going to close with Acoustic Traveler.
On Vanguard Records.
Thank you so much, John.
Well, thank you.
lovely. And now we'll continue with another number that he's got here that I thought was very romantic. It's called Moonlight Dancing. Those of you listening, it's pretty obvious that I'm not a professional disc jockey, and I have very little practice or experience, so I'm going to make mistakes, I'm assuming. In any case, if anyone can do this better and loves John McEwen music, you're invited to write to news at syndicatednews.net. Maybe you can do a better job. Now then, we want to let you know that American Music Show is on at 11 at syndicatednews.net, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Every other Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we have Family Matters, and that show is hosted by Jill Agisi. She's a Chicago alderwoman, and she's also the president of the Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, and the Honorable Judge Michelle Lawrence. She's a family court judge in Cook County, one of the largest family courts in the nation. That's every other Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the 2011 nominee in the category of history for the Pulitzer Prize, Mr. Richard S. Lowry, well, he doesn't have a scheduled time. He comes on when the need arises and he wants to make a commentary on something that's happening worldwide. He's an extremely intelligent man that understands the world, and his book Fallujah in the Marine website is voted, 77% of the vote for the book that best describes the circumstances in Fallujah. And that the voting is done by Marines who are there. So these are people who are experienced and are in the action and understand Fallujah. And apparently they feel, they seriously feel, that he describes the circumstances in Fallujah better than anyone. And of the four books, he's got 77% of the vote. That's remarkable. Now, every Friday, for the male perspective, we have Dr. Kevin McGuire. He's a doctor of osteopathy. His medical practice is in Anchorage, Alaska, and he's the host of Men Matter. He has a male perspective of parental alienation, divorce issues, things that happen while a family is undergoing divorce or separation. And he has wonderful guests. This past Friday, he interviewed Mike Jeffries, who wrote the book A Family's Heartbreak. And you can listen to that segment by going to www.syndicatednews.net. And Men Matter, the show hosted by Dr. McGuire, is on every Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And myself, Ruthie, I interview artists or performers, business men and women, every now and again, no specific time. And if there's something really, really interesting or an extremely important point you'd like to make, we invite you to write to syndicatednews.net. The email address is news@syndicatednews.net. And let's play another John McEwen song. This one is Spinning Wheel. Thank you all for joining me, and we have a few minutes left. I'm trying to think of something I might have left out, but of course, we'll come up with it next Friday. John McEwen's show, the American Music Show, is on every Sunday at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we'd love to have you join us. We see quite a few there sitting around chatting in the chat room. Thank you for coming. We appreciate that you joined us. We really do. And we can't get enough of John McEwen's music. And luckily tonight he's somewhere in Nashville recording some more for us. And we'll see you next week. And let's find another lovely song of his to say goodnight with. Let's see. Mysterious Banjo. Let's try that.